So yeah, so I'm a psychiatrist. I went to University of Texas, Southwestern, and I stayed for residency, and I was on the faculty there for a time, and then I went into private practice, and I still teach there. I teach med students and residents. And my practice is specialized in anxiety disorders, and so, which, there aren't many psychiatrists in Dallas that really specialize in treating anxiety. And anxiety disorders for me have been a great way of getting into one, cognitive behavioral theory. So there's something called cognitive behavioral therapy. It's widely seen as kind of alternative to Freudian psychoanalytic therapy, but they may be doing very similar things. But I'm going to be talking about some of these concepts in cognitive behavioral therapy and how they relate to the idea of virtues in Aristotle. Okay, and so there are a lot of directions I can go, and I'm very happy speaking, and so I'm going to try to keep it shorter so that the questions people have can kind of guide some of the direction. That, so if there's something that interests you, kind of make note of it. And at the end, maybe we can see how to follow up on it. I want to start with talking about insight. So there's this lure that insight has. In fact, there are types of psychotherapy called insight-oriented psychotherapy. You know, Freudian therapy in general has been called insight-oriented. And I want to just draw to your mind the idea of the sirens in the Odyssey. And the sirens, you know, are these creatures. It's actually not really clear. They seem to be part bird, part women. Maybe there are two of them. And they have this ability to have this irresistible draw for men who are sailors passing by. And so Odysseus wants to experience their song. And so he has his men put wax in their ears so they can't hear the sirens. And they tie them up to the mast so that he can hear them. And what the sirens tell him, they're trying to beckon him to the shore. Now Circe had told him earlier that the island they're on is littered with the rotting bodies of men. So it doesn't seem like the sirens eat men, but somehow the men just stay there and rot. So what he hears them say is this. The sirens promise him that he will be able to leave. And they say, once he hears to his heart's content, he sails on a wiser man. We know all the pains that the Greeks and Trojans once endured on a spreading plain of Troy, when the gods willed it so. All that comes to pass on the fertile earth, we know it all. What they're promising him is this powerful lure of knowledge. And the sirens are appealing to something spiritual in him, this desire to know. And they say that they know where he's coming from. They know his suffering. They know his whole past. They know everything that's happened, and they know in the future too. So the sirens possess this knowledge, they promise. And that's this powerful lure that draws them in. And that's the lure of insight. And when many people come to a psychiatrist, that's what they're looking for. You know, they're wanting an insight, this kind of knowledge as the cure. And if only I have this knowledge, and some therapists might even suggest that they know all about your past. You know, they know exactly where you're coming from, they know where you're going. They're kind of almost like a guru or something, this personal prophet. You know, but there's something very sirenic about that. You know, about this drop in insight-oriented therapy. And it ties into something called the Socratic fallacy, you know, which is, there's actually a couple versions of it. One is that if you only know what is good, you'll do the good. So knowledge is virtue. And if someone doesn't have virtue, it's because they're somehow ignorant. So I guess it would be that if you always have that second piece of cake, it's because you don't really know what is bad about that. Now, it seems kind of absurd up front, but it is actually the same thing as the insight cure. You know, that many people are after when they go to psychiatrists. They're just wanting to have some bit of knowledge. Why do I do what I do? So they get sad. They get this lure in their mind of trying to figure out the sadness. Trying to see, where did it come from? How did it start? Why am I sad? Why do I do these things? And that lure of insight drives a process called rumination. It's this repeated dwelling on the past, on those problems, on those feelings. If it's applied to the future, it's worry. You know, this trying to figure out the future and make it safe by somehow getting insight into it. Like, if only I can see all the threats coming up, then I'll be safe. So keep thinking about all the possible things that can go. So somehow this word insight is actually not just an issue in psychotherapy. It's at the heart of what drives psychopathology. Because that process applied to the future is what generates anxiety disorders. And applied to the past is what drives depression. So if you want to become depressed, then you ruminate. And the best thing is to do nothing else. Solitary confinement is, I think, a particularly cruel kind of punishment, because the person is just there with nothing else to do but think about their past. You know, and others there, and it's kind of like you're trying to induce depression in them. In fact, it's profoundly depressing. The benefit of this approach, though, is that if only it could work, it would be really fast. And it would be really cheap, too. Because if you can figure it out just by thinking about it, well, we haven't really had to do anything. We haven't had to buy anything, haven't had to change anything. So knowledge is something that we think that we can somehow search it in our minds and find it, and then it'll cure our anxiety or sadness. And that's why people sit and think. And you see people lost in thought, just staring out. That's kind of what they're doing, right? They're just in their minds. They're detached from the present moment, detached from the here and now. And somehow they've transported themselves to the future, past. I often think it'd be interesting if we humans had the ability that if our mind went somewhere else, our bodies would go with us. So think, what would the world be like? You know, you'd always be with people who are popping in and out. because you think about being home, and then suddenly you'd be home. Or you'd be in the past. How many of us would actually be here the whole talk? At some point, I would have an empty room. Okay. And then there'd be an empty podium, too, probably. At some point. Because it's so easy for us to get caught in the future or in the past. Okay, so that's So the word insight is what I want to use as, in talking with Socrates, there's actually a real parallel in some ways between the developments that led to Aristotle and the developments that led to Aaron Beck in cognitive behavioral therapy. So if the Freudian approach tends to be more Socratic and going after insight as the cure, the Beckian approach is definitely more Aristotelian and turning towards virtues. The cognitive behavioral therapy developed in the 1960s and 70s by Aaron Beck, but it's much bigger than what Aaron Beck came up with, and now encompasses a kind of wide school, you could say, of different approaches. But they all have some things in common. They have the view that our emotions, I'll just say briefly some things about cognitive behavioral therapy so we're all on the same page. The original hypothesis is that all disorders of mood are first disorders of thought. So it's that distorted thinking leads to distorted moods. And so depressive thinking leads to depressive moods. There's a little bit more of a nuanced way of looking at it now. It's not simple cause and effect like that. But these things certainly go together. Okay. The emphasis, though, on CBT is more on the values that constitute a good life. And the goal when a person comes to a cognitive behavioral therapist is less feeling good, even though there's an unfortunate early book called Feeling Good, which is about CBT. But the goal is not so much making yourself feel better as being able to live a fulfilling life. And CBT doesn't tell people what a fulfilling life is, but it's having a life that has values. That there's something in something as a goal that you're working towards, some ideal that you're moving towards. And these things would be, how a person is in one's relations, and so being a good, good father, a good son, a good lover, a good husband, these things, and then you even get more into that, what would you really do? So often a cognitive behavioral therapist would ask the person, what would it be like if they weren't depressed? Or if they weren't anxious, what would they be doing? And what would their life look like right now? What would be the meaningful things? There's the epitaph exercise, which is, let's write your gravestone epitaph. And see, what would you like to go on in? Which is a bit of a jarring kind of, thing, especially if you're working with someone suicidal. But I think you'd have to use some, prudence. But, the the goal is, you know, people have to have something that would determine, you know, what is my life going in the right direction? And it can't just be, do I feel good? Because what happens when people have emotional disorders is that living without that emotion becomes the goal of life. So a person with an anxiety disorder, and I believe that there's only one anxiety disorder, you know, and it takes different forms, and that's the way the field is moving. Anxiety, the disorder in anxiety, problems like panic disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, all of it is a phobia of anxiety. The people are desperate not to feel anxious. The goal of their life is then to live, you know, anxiety-free. And it's almost like there's nothing else in life anymore. And what kind of, you know, marriage would you have if you're anxiety-free? Well, I'll get to that when I get there. You know, and unfortunately, the medicalization of psychiatry, you know, which started out, our main thing was psychotherapy. But then, with the advent of medicines and, you know, other more somatic treatments, it ends up being that doctors are also complicit in telling their patients that the goal is to have no anxiety. So, you know, the goal of life is to be anxiety-free, so take Xanax, or take Valium. And then they come in for their follow-up appointments, and is it working? Well, I'm having any anxiety? Yes, I'm still having some. Okay, let's go up on the dose. Right? But it's not teaching people that somehow it's wrong to have anxiety, and that anxiety is actually intolerable. The use of knowledge is that it helps us to be problem solvers. You know, knowledge is very good at helping us to solve real-world problems. And so knowledge, you know, all the conveniences of modern life, all these things are the development of man's knowledge and insight. Now, the problem is if you try to use that problem-solving approach to emotions, because emotions are not problems, and they can't be solved. So if your main thing is trying to, you know, problem solve, you know, how do I get out of this feeling? Well, then you've just made that feeling a problem. And that's the core of it. So actually, people have a problem with frustration tolerance. The real issue is that being frustrated frustrates them. So that the slightest amount of frustration starts to become intolerable, because they get frustrated already being frustrated. And the same with anxiety disorders. And so a person has a fear of becoming anxious, that's a much different phenomenon than just becoming anxious. You know, so like, say, talking in public. You know, so anyone who's going to be performing in front of a group would have some level of anxiety. And I'm not particularly anxious speaking in front of groups, but just for this, I ask myself, okay, how high is my anxiety? My scale is 0 to 10. You know, maybe a 3 or something like that, which means you're awake, you know, and you're thinking and so. Now, but that's where it would end, because for me, having anxiety isn't a problem. But if a person is an anxiety phobe, you know, if they have a phobia of anxiety, even a 3 would start to make them more anxious. And they think, oh, well, I'm getting anxious. And they get anxious about that. And they're suddenly at a 10 out of 10. And that's a panic attack. So often what we're doing is trying to break this thing. Well, so if emotions aren't problems to be solved, how do we order them? You know, and how does one shape one's emotions? Just to get into a bit of going back to Aristotle, you know, that and any of the virtues. Virtues are essentially the well-ordered passions. So if a person has fortitude, that means that the passion of fear responds appropriately, you know, not too much, not too little, you know, in a given threatening situation. So if they have too little fear, they'd be rash. If they have too much fear, they would become cowards. And so there's the golden mean. And you can always in a virtue locate what's the mean here. But when you start thinking about really virtues are the same as values. So when modern psychiatry talks about values, it's really talking about virtues. In the literature, they say if you want to define a value for yourself, it has to be a verb and an adverb. It's always an action, doing something, and doing it in a particular way. And that's getting at the exact idea of what a virtue is. You know, it's a certain disposition to act. In the book, The Nicomachean Ethics, it's Aristotle's treatment of the virtues. It's not a long book. It's sometimes a bit difficult to get into. I don't know if people have tried to. Has anyone tried to read any Aristotle, Nicomachean Ethics? It can be a bit challenging because he says in book two that the goal of this is to basically help the reader live virtuously. But he says otherwise that our inquiry would be a waste of time. This is the goal. But then he says, well, the way he goes through laying it out, it doesn't read like a self-help book. You go through it, and it's like, boy, how do I apply this? But he's actually laying out principles that are in many ways identical to the developments that happened, in psychotherapy in the last 20 years. The simple formula that Aristotle gives for virtue, or growing in virtue, how to acquire it, is being able to enjoy the right pleasures and endure the right pains. And so virtues are actually about actions that have pleasure and pain. And if you are going to try to order a passion, you're going to have to, every passion has a reference to pleasure and pain. So let's talk a little bit about passions. Okay, I really like using whiteboards. I hope everyone can see it. In the Aristotelian system, there are 11 passions, and that's not meant to be an exhaustive list, but I'm just going to tell you briefly, in case you're really into wanting to know more about how these virtues work. Virtues are simply your response to something. Something that comes to you through the senses, or through your thoughts, or your memory, your imagination. So these are always a passive response. That's why they're called passions. And that's why I like to use the word passions, actually, instead of emotions. A passion is a passive response to some active principle, which is a thought, an image, or a sensation. So those things are considered active because they're about something. They have some kind of intention, an object that you're seeing, or that you're calling to mind, that you're imagining. And the passions respond to these active principles. Well, if you take your stance towards something good in general, the response is love. And something evil, not necessarily moral evil, just something bad, it's hate. If you take it as something absent that's good, it's desire. Something absent that's bad, it's aversion, because you don't want to get in front of it. If it's something present that is evil, it's sadness. If it's something present that's good, joy. And then you get to the next level of virtues on adrenaline, and those are anger, which is some evil that is present that must be vigorously repelled. Hope, which is some good that you strongly desire and you have to get over an obstacle, so it takes some adrenaline. Daring, because there's some evil that can be overcome, so you have to fight it. Despair, there's some evil that can't be overcome, so you give up. And fear, which is that there's some evil not yet present that you can, that is going to be difficult, some arduous evil. Okay, so fear, that's the basic categories. Shame, embarrassment, all these things are mixes and shades. And those things apply to certain situations and types of things. Now, there's a kind of framework that Aristotle lays out in the Nicomachean Ethics that is exactly, in a way, he's describing, you could say, what takes place in psychotherapy. Okay, that you're trying to get people to a state where there's a union between what their passions want and what they're actually choosing and what their intellect approves. Let's say the opposite of that is called vice. Now, vice here is not meant to be so pejorative because it could apply to things that aren't necessarily moral, but certainly moral evils would be vices. So I'm going to start drawing here. So if you have vice, you can think of a vice in terms of the passion is what the person, let's say we're talking about pedophilia. They take real clear vice. Well, a pedophile desires, this kind of inappropriate sexual fulfillment. You'd say his actual desires are disordered. So the passions themselves are disordered. The active pedophile is actually doing it, and so he's choosing to do it. It's not just he has desires, but he's acting on them. So his actual will, his choices, you could say,
or disorder. But will is really the thing just as choice. And the real vicious one in their silly sense is one who says that what he's doing is fine. You know, there's no problem. So the intellect is disordered as well. Then there are these other states, the incontinence, continence, and virtue. In the state of incontinence, the person knows that what he's doing is wrong, but he still does it, and his passion still incites him to do it. So the intellect is actually ordered, but the will and the passions are still disordered. But let's say you work with him, and he gets motivated enough to totally stop doing his pedophilia. You get to a point where his will is not ordered, because he's actually choosing to not act on it, but these bad impulses, you could say, are still there, these disordered passions. So there's still disordered passions, but the intellect and the will are now ordered. And finally, in the state of virtue is, by repeated actions of saying no to his impulses habituate. And Aristotle is the first philosopher to talk about habituation. You know, that's us. And in habituation, any impulse or urge that's not acted on will diminish. And so eventually you get to the point where what he wants is no longer pedophilia. You know? That and we'll talk about how to get to that final stage. You know, that's the part that takes the most practice. Okay, so this is kind of the framework that Aristotle lays out. Very, very rational. Thomas Aquinas refines it and actually makes this layout possible. Now, the thing is, I said that this is not really an Aristotle talking about moral evils necessarily. You know, it applies to any passion. So we can think of this same framework in the context of, now let's say, an addiction. Okay. So a person is addicted to cocaine and thinks it's a great thing, and they have all these cravings that they don't use it, and they keep using it, then they're in this state.
Is virtue the absence of vice?
No, virtue is the well-ordering of the passion.
Because if you look at those zeros on the far right, and you look at the column that says vice, the disorders that follow progressively across the left to right.
Yeah, so...
All you've done there is create virtue in the absence of vice.
No, it's actually the ordering. It's the ordering of the passion to desire.
How does that chart explain that?
Okay, so the O's are ordered.
Okay.
Yeah, not zero. Yeah. Okay. So in the case of say alcoholism, okay, where the person thinks they have no problem, you know, this is called actually in the literature pre-contemplation, because they're still acting, you know, on their impulses and their cravings for alcohol, and so they're actively drinking and they're approving of it. They're not yet even thinking of it. If they might have a problem. The next stage is called contemplation, which is now they will admit that the drinking is disordered, you know, that this, you know, something needs to change, but they're still drinking, you know, as much as ever. And, you know, I'm not saying all drinking is disordered. And an alcoholism, some severe alcoholism. On that stage. This is called action. You know, in action, the person is actually having to battle and to experience and conquer cravings that are not being in any way, you know, reinforced by drinking. So they have to withstand a craving without acting on it. Okay? So that's called the action phase. And then the last one is called maintenance, which is the closest thing you get to virtue. Which is they're not actually having strong desires to drink anymore. There might be occasional triggers, you know, that come up, and then they have to be careful. And so there's some situations where they know they have to be careful. But for the most part, it's not like it was back, you know, going here. Now, knowledge does get people a little bit of the way. You know, but there are these other steps of motivation and practice, you know, to get people, into what we would call virtue. Even though we don't like to use the term virtue, because it's so... ethical. So, you know, and then people think that they have a fall, that they're now bad people. And okay. So, now, the case of anxiety disorders, the disordered passion is fear. So, a patient with OCD, has a terrible fear of, let's say it's body fluids. And so anything that could be remotely related to body fluids, like handles in public, he's terrified of. Okay? And so if he were to touch one, he would run to wash and get it off him. If he were to say that that's reasonable, he would still be in this stage, the pre-contemplation stage. Because he's having this disordered fear, acting on it, and improving it. But usually I don't see these people. I see people in this stage where they know that it's wrong. They know that this is a crazy thought. I have this fear that I run people over. So it takes me 3 hours to get to work because I just keep flying around in circles to double check. I specialize in OCD. It's one of my main things. And you have these people that suffer enormously. And they will tell you, this anxiety thing is totally just taking over my life. I can't do anything. Then the action stage is the continent stage. That's actually the most interesting stage. And that's what I'm going to be focusing on really for the rest of the talk. I see these two as really blending into each other. Because there's no definite point at which a person's emotions are perfectly ordered. Nor is the goal having perfectly ordered emotions, necessarily. The main thing is that they're not acting, on these things. They're not reinforcing them. Now, getting into what drives certain ones. So, one of the things that we have to prevent is the automatic acting on urges. Okay? So we'll talk just briefly about how the emotions affect the way we think and the way we act. So emotions affect the way we think by causing evidence that would support the emotion to resonate more, to have more weight. So if you're anxious about something, any evidence of threat will resonate much more strongly. So if you're in the middle of, if you're in your house in the middle of the night and you hear the breaking of glass, your immediate thing is someone is, there's a threat. Someone is coming into the house. Now you might try to say, well, probably it's just the wind and there's a, branch or, there might be other evidence that go against this threat conclusion, but it's not going to resonate with you. If a person is terrified of spiders, you may, when you try to offer them your tarantula, you may tell them they don't bite. Even if they do, it's not that bad. So it's not really a threat. But that's not going to what's going to resonate to them is the way it walks, there's this threat, in the tarantula. So anything that a person would have an anxiety disorder about, there's some overestimation of threat that's going on, underestimation of their ability to cope with that threat. So evidence of threat with anxiety is what tends to resonate. With sadness, it's evidence of unlovability or helplessness or incompetency. So you might tell a person who's depressed, sometimes it's shocking, people who are incredibly successful, and they feel like they're totally incompetent. And yet, any evidence that comes in their life just doesn't resonate with them. And they can be winning awards, they can be getting promotions, they can get raises, and it just doesn't resonate. That evidence has no weight. And that's the cognitive distortion that emotions cause. Which you see reference to in Aristotle, and Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas is one who goes through this most thoroughly in the Summa Theologica. This has been known for 800 years, explicitly. And yet, this is the cognitive part of cognitive behavioral therapy. So it's getting people to deal with evidence, to try to restore the power of contrary evidence. But the acting is even more important. Okay, and every emotion produces, so thinking is all about evidence, acting is all about urges. Each emotion produces a characteristic urge. So with anxiety, the urge is to flee, to avoid. With sadness, the urge is to withdraw. With the anger, the urge to punish. So much so that emotions, these passions, are actually defined in Aristotle as appetites. They're appetites for something. And so sadness is actually an appetite and a way to withdraw. And fear is an appetite to flee. And anger is a desire to punish. So I'll just stick with these are. And despair is to give up, which is a little different than withdraw. And despair actually is an adrenaline emotion, and it leads to dramatic action. So suicide is a real threat with despair, where sadness on itself doesn't tend to produce suicidal thoughts. But despair makes people want to give up completely. It's also interesting that when you start antidepressants, these are the emotions that the fear and the despair and the anger are the three that tend to flare when you start an antidepressant. So if anyone has ever started the Lexapro or Zoloft, you can get a lot of anxiety right away. And you can also get irritable, and you can also have suicidal thoughts. So these things tend, because they're somehow it works on the adrenaline-related emotions. So when you get an urge, your future life of that emotion depends on what you do with it. Okay. So let's talk about fear. So I have a person then who's afraid of, touching handles in public. Now, if I were to have him go and touch that handle and then wipe it on his face, put it in his hair, go all over, his anxiety is going to shoot up. This is a 10. This is a 0. And then I ask him, what would happen if at this point, what's going to be the future of your anxiety if you don't wash? And they always think it's just going to stay high forever, which actually can happen. But I'll get into that. The underlying thing that has to be addressed in doing these kind of exposures is the willingness of the person to experience the emotion. So it's unwillingness to experience an emotion that makes people give in to urges. So if you are unwilling to be anxious, and let's say you have a fear of heights, and then I have this nice little 3-foot balcony on the 80th floor of a building, and I want you to stand up there, okay, and I have these doors behind you. If you are unwilling to feel the anxiety when it comes, you're going to try to escape, because you're going to have this strong urge. Your reporting of anxiety and the intensity of the urge is the same thing. In fact, I really think that the urge is the emotion. They are these appetites. So the urge to flee actually is the anxiety. The anxiety is going to be very high, and they're going to feel desperate to leave. If they leave, their anxiety would drop down like that. They leave the balcony. Now the anxiety is mostly gone. Because they were unwilling to experience the anxiety. This is called a traumatic exposure. Because their brain will remember that being on that balcony is equal to a 10. And that's the last thing it got to learn about the balcony. If they had been willing, though, to experience the anxiety and just let it come and actually attend to it, to feel it, this is what happens. And we know a few things about this curve. We know that it is less than 90 minutes, unless there's some other reader factors, too much caffeine or something. And if you repeat it, it's less than 11 times. And it always has basically the same shape. And this is what an unfulfilled emotion looks like, if you're willing to have it. At first, it seems big. And then each time you have it, it gets less and less, given the same trigger. Now, it's tough to have exactly identical triggers. When you're doing exposure work for anxiety, I try to construct ones that can be the same every day. So people get to experience this diminution in the fear.
Have you measured the anxiety level?
It's just a subjective report.
That's a what?
It's a subjective report. You just ask them on a scale of 0 to 10.
Yeah, in baboons, you can do it by analyzing the cortisol, I think.
Yeah, humans' cortisol has never been shown to correlate to anything except suicidality.
Interesting.
Yeah, so decrease the cortisol in the cerebral spinal fluid.
Different biochemical correlation.
Yeah.
But it would probably correlate with adrenaline. I'm not sure if we have great ways of measuring this, but in mice, this is true of all mammals, actually. And I haven't heard of insect anxiety studies. But anxiety is nice one to study because the pathway is very simple. You know, that you have the amygdala, which helps you detect threats. It operates with your memories, and it's what gives an emotional cue to memories. But the amygdala essentially is a big threat detector. If it locates a threat, it fires off your fight or flight response, so the HPA axis. You end up getting the surge of adrenaline. And so the experience of anxiety is reported very similar among all people.
Is heart rate a function of anxiety?
Yes, because of adrenaline. Yeah, so you know, adrenaline has...
easier to measure,
though. Yeah, but I guess even with a given person, their response to the adrenaline and their heart rate will vary, depending on other factors. So sometimes the people are real sensitive to that effect, sometimes not, even while panicking. Shortness of breath, feeling oxygen starved, is another effect of adrenaline. Turning white or red, either dilation or constriction of the capillaries. Trembling is an effect of adrenaline. The other intense, I'm sweating, is adrenaline. The other intense effects that people have when they're anxious, they get dizzy, they feel unreal, and that's caused by hyperventilation. So if you hyperventilate, you reproduce those really easily. And if you give people adrenaline, you reproduce the other ones. So it's actually a pretty neat emotion to work with in that sense, you know, that and really don't know how it works. So what makes it stay long is if the person were on the balcony and decided they needed to stop, and I'd lock the doors behind them. So a successful escape goes down real fast, but thwarted escape stays. Oops, I'm running out of time. So thwarted escape tends to, but really what would happen is each attempt at escaping would make it go up. And if they went enough time between attempts, things like it would go away. So they would habituate to it as long as you're not making repeated attempts. The point of that is that the underlying thing that drives the maintenance of the anxiety is the unwillingness to have it. You know, if a person is unwilling to have an emotion, they will have more of it. There's a number of reasons for it. There's a number of interesting, like, neuroanatomical things that go with this. Like, if you're a person who hates the clinking of silverware, you know, you're going to have more of it in your life. Because whenever it happens, you're going to notice it. You know? So, you know, why is that? You know? Well, it's because we have an organ called the thalamus. And the thalamus is the gatekeeper for sensation going to your cortex. And the thalamus seems to control the bandwidth that different signals get. And if you're unwilling to experience something, that opens up the bandwidth for it. So, you know, prototypically, mother is unwilling to hear her baby cry. So the baby can be crying in a room, you know, with a bunch of other noises, but she immediately picks up on it. Because her thalamus is tuned into her unwillingness. The idea is it's supposed to drive her into action. You know, the noise in the middle of the night in your house. Okay? You're unwilling to have an intruder in your house, so your thalamus wakes you up. The thalamus doesn't sleep, and so if it detects something you should know, you get it. Your name said in a conversation that you're not a part of. You know, we're all a little bit unwilling to be spoken of behind our back, you know, and so we pick up the name. Actually, seriously, we even pick up a couple seconds before our name. Somehow, you know, the thalamus is able to, you know, it's such a powerful effect. So, because this is the way that the thalamus is trying to look for problems, you know, if there's something you're unwilling to have, you will tend to notice it more. And that's a real kind of rule of this kind of cognitive therapy. So, unwillingness produces more of something in your life. The more willing you are to have something, like if you're willing to have a room that's a little bit hot, then you don't even notice the temperature right now. Because you're okay with being there. And if you're willing to have some background noise, then you don't even notice it. The more willing you are to have something, the less it jumps out at you. Now, there's nuances here, and there's a lot of, you know, things that you can say about it. But what happens when a person actually lets themselves experience an emotion is that even their thalamus starts to reprogram. and it's not going to hyper-report this emotion every time. So a real problem is when people, well, let's say cravings. If whenever you have a craving for something, you know, like for sweets, if you were immediately to be dominated by that thought, where it's really just taking over your consciousness, you would be driven towards automatic behaviors that would tend to fulfill that craving. So, sort of food-seeking behavior, you know, this automated food-seeking behavior often happens in response to cravings. Even before people know they have a craving, they might realize that they're in the cupboard, you know, and they're kind of going through the food, or you're looking for something. Automatic behavior, it's, you know, I get this a lot, you know, working with men who have issues, like, where they're not wanting to view pornography on the internet, but they keep falling, they keep doing it, falling into it. You know, but what happens is, they're on the internet, and then they kind of get into this autopilot mode, and before they know it, they're, again, looking at something. And it's like autopilot, just because they're not aware of these cravings, you know, they're starting to happen. They're not aware that they're in the usual trigger spot, you know, and so they end up going right into automated behaviors again and again. And for some, it's really debilitating because they can't work, they get fired for this kind of stuff, but they felt like they didn't even want to do it. It just kept happening again and again and again. With anxiety, the automated behavior is to avoid. So people end up automatically avoiding a whole bunch of things. And they're like, I just don't drive on high roads. I just don't go on highways. You know, they have all these little rules for themselves, you know, but before they know it, their life is totally constricted, you know, because of this automatic avoidance. So every emotional disorder is maintained by automated behaviors. You know, there's something that, so the person may not even be aware of the underlying emotion. They just do the behavior. So we need a way of breaking that autopilot. If you're going to try to get someone to stop reinforcing a behavior, you know, and be moving into continence. So this gets them into the essence of continence. This middle state, you could say, between, you know, knowing it's bad, but doing it anyway, and then not even wanting to do it. And continence is mindfulness. So if people have ever heard of mindfulness, people are much into the mindfulness thing, the continence is mindfulness. It's actually mindfulness about unruly passions. Because virtue is also mindfulness, but in that case, the passions are ordered. So if you're mindful of a strong emotion that's leading you to do something that you don't really want to do, so you're very angry at your spouse, and, you know, so the urge is to lash out and to say something really nasty, and you really want to do it, you know. Well, in order to break the automated cycle of just doing it every time, you know, you have to first become more mindful of yourself. Mindful of when the anger is occurring, you know, which is a kind of a sincerity with self, but it's really an awareness. So mindfulness is a non-judgmental awareness of what's taking place right now. And the reason it needs to be non-judgmental is because if you keep judging that the emotion is bad, that kicks you into unwillingness, which kicks you into automated behaviors to make that emotion stop. Well, the quickest way to make an emotion stop is to act on it. So when a person is always venting their anger, that person desperately doesn't want to feel angry. They're unwilling to feel angry. So as soon as it comes, they try to get rid of it. And when you get rid of it, it's by giving into the urge. Or a person is desperate not to experience cravings. You know, they, as soon as the urge comes, they act on it. You know, so they don't even get aware of the craving. And same with, you know, all the other ones. So, with mindfulness, people become aware of having the emotion, and that awareness gives them the space, you know, to not act on it, but to just experience it. It turns out that experiencing fully an emotion is the opposite of acting on an emotion. And they're incompatible. You can't really act on an emotion while you're mindful of it. You know, while you're just letting yourself experience it. Not that, but when you allow yourself to be mindfully aware of an emotion, you become calm. Because the activity of being aware of an emotion is actually a calm activity. You know? Even if the emotion you're being aware of is very agitated. You know, being aware that you're angry is actually relaxing. You know, but just acting on having anger and then trying desperately to get rid of it, that's not wise. And it leads to regret.
So the essence of continence is this ability to maintain an awareness of an emotion in the face of it, you know, without acting on it, and then to experience the natural habituation to it. So mindfulness naturally leads to habituation. It's the lack of mindfulness, which is autopilot, mindlessness, you know, that reinforces the negative emotions. Now, all of this really is in Aristotle. You know, the idea of continence being a facing up to an emotion, you know, he says that it's the same thing as endurance. You know, and it's endurance to this interior state. You know, so what you're enduring is the pain of the emotion. So the virtues and vices are all pleasure and pain. Continence is the ability to have the pain of an emotion that you're not acting on, while not fleeing from the experience of it. In doing that, Aristotle is really, and Aquinas after him, they have laid out a whole program, actually, for how to develop virtue, you know, how to achieve, you know, habituation, how to order passion, how to do it not by trying to just, you know, command it to go, you know, like you can't command yourself to be happy. That would mean having despotic power. You know, you can command your arm to move, you know, because you have despotic power over your limbs. But you can't command an emotion. You know, emotions have to be persuaded. It's a different kind of rule we have. And so they actually call it a political rule. So you have to, it's a political rule. The relationship with us and emotion and our emotions is that of a ruler to a free person. You know, so you have to give them reasons, and then, above all, you have to allow them to habituate, which breaks down that little analogy with the free persons. You know, but habituation is actually what, you know, allows these emotions eventually to be ordered. So, now, I'll stop there, and I'm not sure, you know, how far we are, but perfect. So, and then if there are any questions.
Are you saying that you're ultimately trying to get to the point where you're okay with everything? I'm okay with happiness, I'm okay with sadness, I'm okay with fear, I'm okay with all. I'm like flatline though, aren't I? I mean, aren't I supposed to be feeling, it's okay to vent anger?
Absolutely.
Sometimes.
And so,
you want to vent anger all the time, right?
That's a tricky one. There could be, certainly. And there are times when any expression of anger could be well ordered. And so having an emotion is, emotions themselves are not bad. Having them is not bad. So allowing oneself to have them. You know, the thing is, trying to break the automatic behaviors that result from them. You know, because that's what actually leads to the disordered emotions.
The automatic behaviors that result from them if they're considered to be inappropriate behaviors?
I mean, when we're happy, we're related,
and we laugh, and we... if I were to jump up and down and scream and, you guys would be like, okay, I'm not coming back here.
Exactly. So to act on well-ordered emotions is fine. But they do say that, actually, in the state of virtue, emotions tend to follow action. So the judge, the well-ordered judge, when he or she passes sentence on someone, after the gavel goes down, they get the sensation of anger. You know, so in the virtuous, the emotions tend to be consequent, because it's seen as an inability to endure an emotion if you just give in and act on it right away. But I think in a well-ordered person, these things are pretty harmonious. You know, and the idea is definitely not a flatline, because that would be saying like all emotions are bad, which would produce the desire to act on them right away through the book. Yeah. Yes.
You said that it's a Socratic fallacy that knowledge is a solution to something.
The knowledge is virtue.
The knowledge is virtue.
Yeah.
Okay, so now that I know that I've been reminded that rumination is mindlessness and that mindfulness or awareness of the way that I'm in,
it's really a matter of practice. And so when a person's ruminating, there's usually some aspect of avoidance going on. And so the idea is, what is the person avoiding? You know, there's some thought, there's some kind of, you know, emotion that
drives the rumination. You know, because rumination is really fed by this unwillingness to have an emotion. Rumination itself isn't, and it's not that we want to say rumination is bad, so it has to stop, you know, completely. That would be to turn into a problem. The idea is really, if it interferes with life, you know, how do you get people back on track? So if it's not interfering with life, if it's not stopping you from doing things you would want to do, then there's no need to. This is only for if it was taking over. And if it's taking over, then there are a number of practices that help people to stop. And all of them are mindfulness practices. So the, you know, for instance, the mindful, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard of, like, mindful meditation practices. What's that? Yeah, exactly. So, and there are a number of different, you know, practitioners, you know, who have described ways of doing it. With, like, mindful breathing, for instance, you know, is this awareness of one's breath without controlling it. And so it's actually a perfect metaphor for having an emotion. It's to let yourself feel and be aware without taking charge. You know, which is exactly then what people should do with, you know, the whatever drives the ruminating, which is usually some form of sadness. But I think even more important is mindfulness lived all through everyday life, of being able to ground yourself in the present moment. It's almost like the past is the dominion of rumination, and the future is the dominion of worry. And so we have this small space in between of the present moment, you know, of, you know, where we're actually not under their sway. And that's the space where you have communion with others, you know.
The brain is also an endocrine organ, and the hypothalamus puts out these hormones that elicit emotions, like anger, anxiety, fear, etc. And that this in turn, you know, affects our action too. And then it also affects our thinking. I mean, it's kind of a biofeedback.
Yeah.
And the obvious other hormone, like thyroid, you know, too much, you know, anxious and overactive, too little, and they're lethargic, so it affects, I mean, it's a purely chemical thing. So how does that fit in with cognitive?
Yeah, exactly. Well, first, with the HPA axis, the origin of the cascade is going to be in the limbic system. So, and it's going to be in the amygdala. So that's kind of what I was talking about, like, you know, threat detection. You know, that you sound the alarm, when the amygdala turns on the HPA axis, and you get the adrenaline pumping out. So all the somatic signature of an emotion is actually, that is the emotion. When you talk about being aware of an emotion, we're talking about it actually being aware of the physical feeling of it. So I don't think you can separate, you know, the physicalness of the emotion from what would, you know, kind of like what I've been talking about here, because that's the essential ingredient of it. Now, interesting, there are cases where, like with thyroid, so if you were to start taking way too much thyroid hormone, okay, you would probably start to get more and more anxious. Not necessarily, actually, but most likely, you know, and there are things that can drive the emotions and sometimes trick the brain into thinking it's anxious. And it's more of a feedback mechanism where the brain sees the heart rate going up so quickly, so easily, and it sees the sweating, and it gets actually reinterpreted, you know, as anxiety. Another thing where I think this is very common is in bipolar disorder. I'll say that bipolar, I don't think, fits this model. You know, that what I'm talking about here is more simple emotional disorders. You know, but in bipolar disorder, you have a disorder of energy metabolism, you know, where there are higher energy periods in the brain, which sometimes I think get reinterpreted as euphoria and anger and these things, you know, but in fact, it's just that the brain is extremely keyed up, you know, by an excess of internal energy. And then you have low energy states, which get very quickly identified with depression and tend to coincide with depression. But I think that when people work in therapy and they actually and with mindfulness, you can have people who can have a low episode of bipolar without necessarily being really depressed. So I think that it's more of an energy disorder that has an emotional overlay. But it actually functions a lot, very much to these things where people, and I think there's this kind of reinterpreting going on by the brain.
Yeah, I have a point that perhaps is a disagreement with something that you said, and then a question about your graph and point of view related to what might be the disagreement.
Okay.
You find an emotion at some point, I think you said this, as identical to an urge to act.
Yeah.
That seems a little counterintuitive to me. It seems to me I could perhaps have a strong emotion, yeah, and yet perhaps acquire a tolerance for that emotion that enables me not to act on it. Now maybe that's why I don't understand your graph, and here's what I don't understand about the graph. You described, I think, this as a picture of a certain kind of therapy in which the diminishing curve corresponds to something like a diminishing emotion.
Now, here's the
question. Why would one necessarily see this as having as its aim competence rather than virtue? Insofar as it seems like the goal is to get that emotion to drop down to the point where it hits the goal of mean, where it's an appropriate level of emotion. Why not say this has its goal not competence but virtue? I think the answer to that, because you see no difference between having an emotion and having an urge to act.
No, I think that, so on the thing of urge and emotion being equal, I usually say that because patients have an easier time identifying urges than identifying emotions. I think technically they are different.
I see. And one of the reasons that they are different is that the urges tend to only occur in this part of the curve,
where once you get over the hump of the high emotion, the urge tends to actually go away very quickly. Because people kind of get the sense like, okay, it's going down. So if that person is on the balcony, once they start noticing their anxiety is going down, their urge to escape does really diminish. So it's just my way of trying to get people to identify urges, or identify emotions based on urges, because that is a pretty tight correspondence. And then going back to the other one, I think you're right, that you could just easily say this is all about virtue, as long as it's repeated over time.
Two real simple questions. First, people with personality disorders, could they be anxiety disorder related to inappropriate relationship issues?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a fear of abandonment, and a fear of disillusion of self, even. And so, absolutely, this kind of therapy I'm describing has a formulation specific for personality disorders. It's called dialectical behavior therapy. And the essence of the dialectic is being able to willingly accept the emotion, and also to act in a constructive way. And these things, that's what the talking is.
Second question has to do with new interpretation of dopamine in the brain that serves as a motivator, and that maybe going back to your energy levels, that people who are on the upside of their bipolarism have the increased amount of dopamine in their system, and then they may be lower in their depressive state.
That may be the case, but right now, I think given what we really know about these things, it's kind of science fiction. I don't buy the neurochemical basis. In fact, what you have are certain types of neurons, like dopaminergic neurons, in certain pathways, but that doesn't mean that, necessarily it's about dopamine. It may be more about the pathway. I think the brain, to kind of reduce everything to neurotransmitters or chemical imbalance, I think chemical imbalance is a disservice to humanity, to think of mental disorders as chemical imbalances, because, I think that you're saying is that there's something in the person's brain that's causing them to feel this way.
Aren't you finding that at the medical school? Isn't the department very neurochemical oriented?
Yeah, but they would actually, no one there would say it's a chemical imbalance. It's more of a, I don't know of anyone, and Dr. Talmadge, I'm a professor of mine here, so he's much more familiar with
this.
He's going to report me back to me. No, but I, don't think the chemical imbalance language is ever used by psychiatrists among themselves. Because even if you're saying it's based on, like, pathology in the brain equals mental disorder, you know, which people don't really say that either, even then it would be more the function between units of the brain and certain types of brain activity, but not the chemicals involved.
Using the ideas you just talked about, all the neural pathways we have are reinforced. Mm-hmm. It may be a combination of nature and nurture, and not so much our chemical imbalance.
Exactly.
But you generate the neurotransmitters enough to reinforce pathways as you continue to travel down.
No, exactly. I think that's right. I think we have some inherent inclinations and proclivities to certain types of things. You certainly have people more inclined to anger, more inclined to, you know, one emotion or another. And then life circumstances and how emotions were dealt with at home, you know, makes a huge difference. If emotions are more accepted and seen as something that come and go, that they're not, you know, not these permanent things, you know, and so you get angry and then it goes away, you know, and the more that's allowed and understood, I think people tend to have not these complicated reactions to emotions.
I'm a little rusty on Aristotle, but when you were drawing that previous graph, I was trying to think of how a particular virtue would fit in there, and I was thinking of courage. Mm-hmm. And with courage, for example, if you have a soldier who's hesitant to go to battle, mm-hmm. they're mindful of it, they're willing, mm-hmm. they overcome their passion to live, I guess, and they fight, versus the bloodthirsty warrior who maybe fits this, they're mindful, willing, and they want to fight.
Yeah.
To me, my first inclination is the soldier who overcomes and willingly fights is a better embodies the virtue of courage than the bloodthirsty warrior.
And could there be one who is not bloodthirsty, but, you know, who would have fear, but the fear wouldn't be dominating, it wouldn't be disordered? Because I think the thing here is we're talking about disordered levels of fear. Certainly there's an element of fear that you have to have a mean, because courage is a mean. Yeah, and so it's not saying just the presence or absence of fear would be an issue. It's more how disordered is it. If it's very disordered, you know, and the main issue is enduring the fear itself and not the real thing, you know, that would be more confidence. That's on its way to courage. And so the real inheritor of the Aristotelian tradition is Christianity in the West. And in Christianity, what you're getting is talked about as merit. So the principle of merit is that Christianity, in some sense, turns this and says that virtue is not actually the main thing, but how meritorious something is. So the person who's to conquer more of their internal fear is seen as more meritorious in Christianity, even if it's just confidence. You know, and so and I think it's a true development system. It's just the model doesn't take merit into account.
Okay, so you're saying that by being aware of your emotions and learning to overcome them, you can solve these psychological problems, but which are fundamentally due to biochemical changes in the brain. But
am I saying that, or are you?
Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm putting the words in your mouth incorrectly.
Yeah.
My daughter suffers from panic disorder. Okay, she's been on medication, quite strong medication now, for about 10 years, and she's told that, you know, she'll be on this the rest of her life, and there's nothing she can do about it. And it seems to me that you're saying that there is something that you can do by exposing yourself to mild panic situations and acclimatizing.
Yeah. And okay. Exactly. And also, would there be something visible on the brain if you're in your image? You know, some physical thing different?
Well, there has to be a physical correlation.
There would be some functional difference, absolutely. And therapy makes it go away better than
medicine. But it seems to me that this is only one aspect of it. And, for instance, I'm taking a thyroid medication because, and I've taken it for about 30 years now because my tests show that I have low thyroid levels. Now, would it be possible for me to, by doing certain physical things to raise my thyroid level so that I can get off this or not?
No.
No. Okay. So it seems to me that there's something to be said for both the chemical treatment and the
But the thyroid disorder is not an emotional disorder.
I'm sorry?
The thyroid disorder is not an emotional disorder.
Well, you were saying that some of the emotional disorders are based on thyroid activity.
No, they can be influenced by it, but fundamentally, the emotions habituate, but the thyroid doesn't have the same dynamic.
Thyroid can't be habituated.
No, only emotions. And if the person was on weight or of an overdose,
well,
the thyroid would be higher.
So you're saying that some biochemical aspects of the brain can be habituated and others cannot?
The emotional ones can be habituated.
Right, and you think the panic disorder is the one that can...
Most of what I do is treat panic and OCD. The success rate for remission in panic disorder with these principles is something like 86%.
Okay, I need to get some references.
If you go to the American Anxiety Disorder Association of America, ADAA, they have good references. There's a lot of research on panic disorder. Actually, panic disorder is one of my favorite things to treat. Because it responds really, really well, and sometimes really, really fast.
Well, that's encouraging.
Yeah, and I think that the medicines are a particular disservice in panic disorder.
Particularly what?
A disservice. Because
I can
what they end up telling the person is that the goal of life is not to have panic attacks. You know, it's not. But the essence of panic disorder is not having panic attacks. It's the dread of having a panic attack. And so the medicine feeds the dread. Which is the DSM definition of the disorder, is the dread, not having panic attacks. So it ends up just playing into it, and I don't think they're actually that effective either.
Well, I had a vigorous discussion with her doctor before. Well, actually, she was in the custody of my ex-wife at the time, and with the doctor and my ex-wife against me, I didn't really get very far.
Yeah. No, it's unfortunate. And no, so I have that often with people who have been on medicines for a long time. You first start therapy, and then you gradually get them off the dose. But that one is actually very minimal. The more severe the experience of the emotion is, the easier it is to be willing to have it.
Mm.
And because it's more vivid, and so. Low level chronic things like dysthymia, the chronic mood, is a lot tougher to treat than the real serious punctuated things like panic.
How does hypnotherapy work? I've seen that effect.
I'm actually really interested in hypnotherapy because I think that when you're doing mindfulness exercises, there's a lot of similar things going on because hypnotherapy is a very concentrated attention. And so what we're dealing with here are attentional phenomena. And in hypnotherapy, you are getting into how the brain pays attention to things. That's all I can say right now.
Just a
question.
I'm wondering about schizophrenia, whether or not that can be
That's a very good question. So the cognitive behavioral therapy is effective for schizophrenia. It does have its applications. That's the main focus of Aaron Beck now, the developer of cognitive therapy, is trying to make it more and more effective. There had been this idea that delusions could not be worked with. It's one of the most untested statements ever in psychiatry. This idea that somehow delusions are just unworkable. In fact, cognitive therapy works with delusions. And you do cognitive therapy dealing with evidence directly for the delusion. The kind of stuff as far as habituation can go is the reaction that the person has to having voices. The more distressed they are by having voices, the more voices they have. Because stress causes voices. So you have a positive feedback loop. So if you can break this link between having a voice and having distress, the experience of voices does go down. Which means, it's the same as saying that the more unwilling a person is to have voices, the more they're going to have them. Which is that basic perverse inverse rule of attention. The more willing you are to notice something, the less you do it. And the same with voices.
So do you think that the antipsychotic medications are doing the same thing as the anti-anxiety medications?
No, I think that they're different because they actually stop... What we're dealing with emotionally with schizophrenia is the emotional reaction to a phenomenon. it's not that they're responding to an emotion. They're not having emotions about emotions. They're having an emotion about a voice. And the antipsychotics get rid of the voice. In anxiety disorders, they're having anxiety about anxiety. And in depression, the real emotional disorders are all what are called secondary emotions, which are emotions about emotions. Primary emotions are emotions about other problems that are extra-psychic, or in the case of schizophrenia, even voices down. So primary emotions don't tend to be disordered. You know, even think of the soldier in battle, that his fear would actually be most likely a primary fear, where he's just afraid of being killed. But if he was afraid of fear, then he has a secondary, and then you get into these positive feedback loops where it gets really bad really fast. And then,
I think he's got to balance the being ashamed of, in front of his fellow soldiers and his folks back home against afraid of being killed. And he chooses to go.
And in fact, courage or fortitude, in Aquinas, it's fortitude, which is the virtue that allows you to face death in battle. And then every other application of the word is just by analogy. And he says that fortitude actually will recruit other emotions like shame and anger. So like you get the soldiers angry about the enemy, and it's a lot easier to repress the action of fear in the soul.
So that's why we tend to demonize the enemy.
Absolutely.
Suppress all our sympathetic...
It stops the soldiers from being cowards. It also reminds them of the loved ones at home, the desire to get to home.
Yeah.
But that can also feed cowardice, so it's tricky. Yeah. I don't think so. But yeah, and I think that RDBT is not such a fluid developing school. Yeah, a kind of fluidly developing school. You know, it's more about Albert Ellis.
Yeah.
And I think that part of the cost of that is that it may not take into account some of the new developments that are always refreshing, you know, things in CBT. But I speak in partial ignorance because I'm not doing the latest stuff in RDBT.
All right, one more question. I'm going to stand up.
I was struck when you put up your Aristotle categories, that Aristotle provided no category for a person whose emotions or passions and will disorder, but intellect is disordered.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
And I'm thinking of maybe like a fan who wants to help his friend Jim escape and does it, but suffers from the judgment that what he's doing is wrong. I wonder what that's missing, and I wonder whether you as a psychiatrist encounters that phenomenon.
Or is the disorder really of judgment?
Yes.
Just along
the passions are fine. And
yeah. I think those are more difficult ones to deal with. You know, it's but like what you do with someone who is I've had patients who were like fanatical about some beliefs. Mm-hmm. You know, but I almost feel like it's not my role to kind of talk them out of their beliefs. Mm-hmm. You know, that you have to respect their freedom, and so it's really, I think that the kind of what I outlay here does really respect people's freedom, because it's trying to appeal to what do they want. You know, what is their actual goal. But what do you do when those goals themselves are disordered? That's not easy, huh? I think that's...
All right.